And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am as excited as I can be because today we're going to be talking about something that has been a long-held love of mine, comic books. But we're going to be talking about them in really serious fashion and actually a very serious and often troubling aspect of a lot of comic books, I would say, especially in their early history, but not exclusively in their early history. It turns out that the comic books that many of us read and loved and remember vividly had just beneath the surface, and sometimes even right at the surface, pervasive racism. And in fact, were in many cases springing from a place of white supremacy. And even characters like Superman and Batman and Captain America and so on that we tend to think of as unblemished heroes for the most part, there is this other aspect to their stories and who they are and what was on the page that really bears examination. And that is what we experience in a fascinating new book called Bandits, Misfits, and Superheroes, Whiteness and Its Borderlands in American Comics and Graphic Novels. This is the product of two faculty members at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, right up the road from us. Doug Singson, who is Associate Professor of Art and Design History and Director of the General Education Program there, and Joseph Benson, Associate Professor of Literatures and Languages, and the author of several previous books, including one called Star Wars, The Triumph of Nerd Culture, and J.D. Salinger and The Catcher in the Rye, A Cultural History. Joseph Benson's been on the morning show before to talk about Parkside's marvelous foreign film series. Doug Singson, I'm pretty sure this is your first visit to the program. So again, they are the co-authors of this book called Bandits, Misfits, and Superheroes, Whiteness and Its Borderlands in American Comics and Graphic Novels, published by the University Press of Mississippi, Jackson. Doug Singson, Joseph Benson, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Great to be here.
So glad that you can be here. This is such a great story. Ahead of us talking specifically about your collaboration on this book and some of the things that you explore, I'd love to hear more generally about your own relationship to comics. I know at one point you say pretty clearly that both of you come at this as fans of comics who nevertheless are not afraid to take a close examination to really scrutinize those comics that probably once upon a time you rather mindlessly consumed and enjoyed. Let's start with you, Joseph Benson.
Thanks. Yeah, I kind of came late to the party when it comes to comics. I was kind of a literature snob when I was young. My dad was a high school English teacher, and so I read a lot of literature early on. And when I went on to get my master's and PhD, primarily focused on literature. But once I graduated, I realized that there was a real opportunity with comics that I felt were kind of under-theorized at the time. And a lot of my background in literature, focusing on African-American literature and whiteness studies, I really saw an opportunity about 2012 when I read a couple of key comics. One was Watchmen, and the other one was The Dark Knight Returns, another one was Mouse. And these were three comics, three sort of, Titan comics that really helped pave the way for comics to be thought of as literature. And once I read those, I thought, wow, here's a great opportunity to apply some of the things that I had been applying to literature to comics. So I pretty much got hooked, but this was very late for me. And so much of my comics reading, which was hundreds and hundreds of comics, were in relation to the book that we wrote. Now, Doug, by way of transition, came to comics much earlier than I did.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, I started reading comics when I was, I don't know, somewhere around 13. I had friends who read comics. They told me about, they would talk about them, and I got interested. and started buying them, and started out in superheroes. But then, you know, within a few years moved, well, I mean, just started getting curious about other genres, started reading alternative comics, which are sort of like, I don't know, not mainstream comics. They're kind of like sort of indie, offbeat, more sort of self-consciously artistic, you could say, avant-garde at times. Although for me also, I mean, Watchmen was huge for me. I mean, I probably read that when I was like 16 or so. And I mean, I still think that's one of the best examples of what comics can do as a medium. I mean, I think it's a straight up masterpiece by any definition. And I mean, you know, we have a whole chapter on it in the book, which is actually, I mean, Joe, the book started when Joe gave a conference presentation on Watchmen and it, in relation to race. And an editor from University of Mississippi Press saw it and actually, you know, usually you pitch books to editors. The editor pitched a book to Joe. He was like, can you turn this presentation into a book? Which, you know, Joe was interested in, and I kind of came on a little bit later. But so, I was reading comics throughout my teen years. And, you know, kind of in my 20s, I guess I would say I stopped reading as many new comics. But, I mean, comics, you know, I mean, I had like several shelves of comics at that point. They were just sort of, you know, had become like part of my cultural background, and ended up in grad school writing my dissertation on comics, which was similar to the editor pitching the book to Joe. My dissertation advisor pitched that topic to me because I was doing something else. And she was like, you know, this topic, it was Jackson Pollock. This has been done a million times, and it's going to be very hard for you to find something new here. But, you know, she knew I was interested in comics, and she was like, you know, I mean, comics, this was like, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, something like that. Comics were just starting to become taken seriously as like an academic subfield. And so, you know, there were tons of topics that nobody had really studied seriously before. And so I ended up doing my dissertation on that, which, you know, and eventually published like several articles from the dissertation. But, you know, that had not been my plan going into grad school. I was, you know, planning on just studying like modern and contemporary art. But I think, you know, I mean, it was real. I'm glad that things ended up going in this direction, because one of my main interests is just sort of, I mean, things that sort of break from patterns, I guess, you know, and don't fit established narratives. So dealing with comics from the perspective of art history was a really good chance to kind of explore some of, well, what we call in the title of the book, borderlands. I'm very interested by borderlands, by spaces where prevailing definitions kind of break down.
And that happens sometimes even in the world of comics. I guess you're fortunate to be coming along at a time when, as you kind of already hinted at, it's okay for serious academic study and research to be done about something like comics. And one has, it's a little hard to imagine maybe 20 or 30 years ago, it feels like it might have been a little bit of a bold step for a professor of literature to be writing a serious exploratory book about comic books and graphic novels. So I assume by now we're well past the point where you feel any sort of hesitancy.
Well, I mean, I think that there's still probably some pushback from old school literary theorists who think studying pop culture in general is a waste of time. But Doug and I have always talked about the fact that In some of the lowest culture, we get the greatest insights about where we are as a culture, because, you know, it's so many people are involved in it, you know, that it sometimes is more interesting than kind of the high-minded, highbrow culture that sort of fewer and fewer people engage with. So, weirdly, like I said, I started off, you know, if it wasn't in the classic section at the bookstore, I wasn't interested. And then much later, you know, I taught a class in rap and hip hop as literature. Comics, of course, treated that as literature, wrote a book about Star Wars, you know, so I wound up being this kind of pop cultural theorist, in spite of myself, I guess.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today on The Morning Show with Joseph Benson and Doug Singson, who are both on the faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and the co-authors of a book called Bandits, Misfits, and Superheroes, Whiteness and Its Borderlands in American Comics and Graphic Novels. This is a really illuminating examination of, in a sense, just how white the world of comic books and graphic novels has been through so much of its history, especially, or maybe more obviously, more clearly, in its early history. But even later, as the comic industry sought to kind of reverse some of this, some of those efforts to do good were also in some cases kind of misguided. One of the things you really take some time earlier in the book to talk about is what you call at one point, and I think this is such a great way to put it, the simultaneous pervasiveness and invisibility of whiteness, like water surrounding a fish. So that idea that when we are living in the middle of something that is everywhere and that we completely take for granted, we end up having absolutely no awareness of it. And clearly you both thought that it was important for the reader to kind of have an understanding of this before delving more specifically into the topic at hand. Why is that so essential for all of us to understand?
Well, I would say at the beginning of any academic book, it's important to define terms, and that's sort of one reason why we spent some time defining what we talk about whiteness, and we're all Doug and I are very conscious of the fact that there is controversy around the idea. And in fact, we think that controversy is part of the definition of the idea. And in other words, whiteness has always functioned as something that was very elusive, that oftentimes, like with fish and water, people don't even realize that they are a part of it, that they are products of it, that they in fact perpetuate it. That its power historically has come from its denial, and the idea that in fact definitions of whiteness have changed over many years, and is a kind of a fluid idea that power structures tend to embrace in order to marginalize certain people. So it's always been a powerful force, certainly within the American culture, that has come to define who's in power and who's not in power. And of course, just like with superheroes, one power I think that a lot of people would choose if they could would be invisibility, because if something is invisible, it's very difficult to attack. Mm. So that's one. Weigh in, you might say, with regard to how we approach whiteness. And there's a number of different sorts of tools. One thing that we were sort of interested in doing in the book is creating a kind of a toolkit for other theorists to use when grappling with other kind of pop cultural artifacts in relation to whiteness. So, you know, just like there's lots of different readings for literature, there's lots of different ways to employ theoretical techniques. So when talking about whiteness in relation to pop culture, there's a number of ways in. And the notion of invisibility is one way in.
And I think also it's important to put that out there right at the beginning, to avoid readers having the sense that these are issues that we've invented, right? Which is something that when people talk about racial injustice or structures of racial hierarchy, I mean, one of the ways that that people try to dismiss those is by saying that the people who are raising the issues are responsible for them, right? So, I mean, and we wrote this book before. I mean, when we wrote this book, I mean, critical race theory was a semi-obscure academic field. It was not a political hot topic that you would hear about on the evening news. I mean, it would be like, you know, having people, one of the, I mean, I think one of the ways that people have tried to discredit critical race theory is by saying that that the people making these critiques are themselves being racist, when what they're trying to do is to draw attention to racial hierarchies that exist. And so I think one natural question for people, you know, it's like if you are someone, and typically, I mean, you know, if you don't perceive racism at work in your immediate environment, and someone comes in and says, you know, hey, XYZ that you are totally used to is racist. I mean, it's on one level, it's kind of a natural reaction to say, what are you talking about? I mean, I've never noticed this before. Why are you coming in and accusing this thing that I love, which might be, you know, superheroes or whatever else? You know, this thing is racist. Like you're taking away my ability to enjoy this. You're impugning this thing that I love. And so I think we had to answer right off the bat, like, why is this something that I have not noticed? Right? And in order to, I think, give ourselves some credibility, you know, to say that we didn't invent this, it's invisible kind of on purpose, right? The fact that it's invisible, as Joe said, is part of what makes it, you know, hard to dismantle, is that if you can't see it, you can't do anything about it.
Right.
Yeah.
It's interesting you phrase it that way, because one of the things we were talking about before we went on the air is that, on the other hand, your book is not about how a given comic artist, Will Eisner or Frank Miller or whoever, whether or not they were feeling or harboring racist or bigoted attitudes themselves. This is not about what was inside their heads. Your book is about what is on the page. And in a sense, there's nothing invisible about what's on the page. I mean, there's a clarity. It's right there for everybody to see. And yet I think what you're talking about is an invisibility, something that's invisible that was behind what's on the page. I mean, what's behind what ends up on the page in these comic books and graphic novels?
I mean, I think what's invisible is the assumptions that we make about people and about why society is organized the way that it is. I mean, there's always kind of, I mean, any sort of social order wants to present itself as being natural.
And this is the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, for whatever reason that might be, you know, because that's the way God wanted it to be, or because, you know, this is what is just, or it's, I mean, whatever the answer is. But I mean, all societies are created by people. I mean, none of them are natural in the sense that they just sort of came into being. None of them are predetermined. They're all the result of decisions made by people. But, you know, that's not, you know, that they often want to just sort of justify themselves as being somehow like immutable or inevitable. And that is part of what makes them invisible, is
right,
that the choices behind them get hidden.
So when you see a chart of all of the U.S. presidents or all of the U.S. vice presidents, and you see a bunch of mostly old white men looking out at you, it is possible that we make assumptions, maybe unspoken, that and of course that's the way it is, or that's kind of the natural order of things, versus something that sprang out of very deliberate choices made by people.
I was just going to say, another way of putting that too is that recognizing the ideological drivers, the ideological forces and vectors that are responsible for what's on the page, that are responsible for, just like you said, all the presidents have been white men, you know, that tends to be invisible as well, and drawing attention to, well, how did this happen? You know, how exactly did these forces come to bear on these comics artists who are largely unaware of their own privilege, unaware of their own whiteness, to the degree of they actually tried to create comics that were anti-racist and failed miserably.
Yeah.
And so why is that, right? Well, that's because that of this water that we've been talking about, which one way to describe it would be a sort of an ideological force that is largely white supremacist, that is very elusive and hard to talk about, which is again part of its strength.
I wanted to just draw in briefly my own relationship to comics. So I'm older than both of you. So I was born in 1960. So I was reading comic books before either of you were born, I'm guessing. And my favorite comic book growing up was The Legion of Superheroes, which was a DC comic. So it'd be kind of like the more famous Justice League of America, but except all the heroes are teenagers. And they come from all kinds of different planets all around the universe or the galaxy. And of course, I never noticed at the time, but every single one of those characters, heroes and heroines, and there were, I don't know, 25, 30 of them, it was a big group, were white, except for one guy from Mars, Brainiac 5, who was green. And likewise, the Justice League of America, they were all white except Martian Manhunter, who was from Mars, and he was green. But that was the closest you came to racial diversity in terms of just the skin color of the heroes that you were seeing on the page. And this, again, would be in the 1960s into the early 1970s, and then slowly but surely, at least on that very basic level, things start to change. Of course, your book is about a lot more than that, than just the skin color of the people that are on the page. It's about much more than that, and also the long history of where comics come from. In fact, maybe we could just talk for a moment about all of the different forces that were kind of at play when we first saw these things that we came to call comics. I mean, a lot of different sort of social issues and movements and so on, and fears, that's the sort of melting pot of different influences that sort of gave rise to all of this. Briefly describe all that was going on that kind of fostered the earliest days of this medium.
Well, I would say one thing that Doug and I did in the book was we sort of assigned each other chapters. And, you know, I did the chapter on Watchmen. I did a chapter on Westerns. Doug did the chapter on early comics and early superheroes and did a wonderful job of sort of delineating exactly what you're talking about, the kind of cultural backdrop out of which comics sprung. So I will pass that to Doug.
I mean, I guess I would start with the fact that the vast majority of the first generation of super or of comic book writers and artists were Jewish. And a lot of them, you know, changed their names to assimilate. So, you know, Stan Lee was Stan Liebowitz, right? Jack Kirby was Jack Kurtzman, and so on. And, you know, they were pretty much all of them were American-born, but most of them, I mean, their parents had immigrated. And so, I mean, they were part of the massive wave of like second generation immigrants coming to the U.S. from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe. And, you know, their communities, maybe, I mean, they themselves might not have been that aware of racism against them they certainly didn't like talking about that. And really, they all downplayed, you know, their ethnicity or religion as an influence on their work. They didn't. They wanted it to be invisible. Their parents had, Jews in the U.S. in the early 1900s did face discrimination. But one thing we talk about a lot in the book is that Jews, along with other white immigrants from Italy, Greece, Eastern Europe, were racially in between in the United States. So on the one hand, they were not given the same treatment that Anglo-Saxon, Northern European whites who had been in the U.S. for generations were given. But they were also not discriminated against as harshly as black people or the Latino community or Asian Americans, who were all treated far worse. So, you know, one of the kind of paradoxes of being a white immigrant. Oh, and they were not considered white at the time. I mean, there were constant discussions going on and legal debates and political debates over whether these European immigrants should be considered white or not white. And David Roediger, as a scholar who's written, did a lot of pioneering work on this. I mean, he calls them conditionally white. So depending on the context and what people in power wanted out of the situation, they could be treated as white, they could be treated as not white. And I mean, the response of the cartoonists, this first generation of predominantly Jewish cartoonists, was to assimilate. And comic books actually was a part of that assimilation. And this gets played out in the character of Superman, who single-handedly built the comic book industry by becoming an overnight sensation and creating, you know, legions of imitators pretty much overnight. And the story of Superman very closely actually parallels the story of Jews fleeing Europe, which was generally done, I mean, partly just to escape the general poverty of Europe, but also specifically to escape their persecution by Nazis or just the general anti-Semitic environment that was the norm in Europe. As in the U.S., although not as extreme in the U.S., right? But so, okay. So Superman is, you know, his origin story is that his planet is exploding and he's sent away by his parents to someplace safe. And when he lands, he's taken to be human, raised by humans and who are white. I mean, he's also white, but he's an alien, but no one can detect that he's an alien unless he uses his powers, which he only does in disguise. So this is, I mean, and a lot of people have pointed out that this is, this tracks very closely with the experience of Jews who are, you know, by skin color are white, but who are not treated as white, or especially at the time, were not treated as white by the dominant, like, WASP culture. They were treated as other, but it was still possible to assimilate, especially if you didn't draw attention to yourself. And so that is kind of what Superman does. But at the same time, he has this superpower, which comes from the fact that he is from this other place. And the sort of last layer of this is that, okay, so Superman is a story about assimilation. But Superman also, I mean, and other superheroes allowed the people making it to assimilate, because Superman became an all-American icon. Right. So Superman actually helped them assimilate by, you know, they became the creators of one of, like, the classic cultural icons of America. So there's all of, you know, so race is, and this is a perfect example of how race really informed what was going on there, but in a totally invisible way.
Right. And of course, nothing could be more American, all American, than Superman. I mean, right down to his red, white, and blue uniform and the old TV show where the American flag is flapping in the breeze as George Reeves stands there in the opening credits. I mean, yes, it's just American, American, American. And of course, on the other hand, one of the things your book explores are the enemies that heroes like Superman and Captain America are beating back, and in many cases, they are part of this so-called yellow peril, or other enemies like that. Maybe one of you could talk about, even before we get to Superman, or maybe it's concurrent with that as well, some of the really overt racist elements that we see in early comics. I mean, even elements of minstrelsy, where we have sort of blackface characters. I mean, it's kind of shocking. I mean, it's not all that your book is about, but I mean, it's important that we touch on some of these really overt examples of white supremacy in the comics.
Yeah, I mean, this one was my chapter also. So, and I mean, this, and, you know, the one of the primary villains in early superhero comics was Japan. The U.S. was at war. I mean, Superman was created in 1938, I want to say. I might be off by a year on that date. But so right before World War II, But, you know, once World War II starts, I mean, all of the superhero character, all of the American superheroes are, you know, supporting the war effort. And in some ways that was totally innocuous. It was like, you know, buy war bonds, et cetera. But part of it also was demonizing the enemy. And actually, and, you know, Germans, despite the fact that, I mean, the Nazis were, you know, from the U.S., well, I guess from the U.S. perspective, actually, the Japanese were the instigators of the war. The Nazis were certainly presented as villains, but Germans as a people were not caricatured to the extent that that the Japanese were. And they were depicted as literal monsters, like yellow skinned, with giant fangs and claws. So totally dehumanized. Now, when Germans were villains, they were villainous, but they were not dehumanized. They were still very much human. So that was the difference. And that was super common and totally accepted. And you see it, I mean, Superman actually did never really, I did not find any examples of racial caricatures in Superman specifically, but almost everywhere else you look are absolutely horrific characters of the Japanese. Hmm. And there are some, and black people there's very little depiction of black people anywhere in early comic books. And that itself is an instance of the white racial frame. They're simply being excluded as though they didn't exist. When they do exist, when they are present, they are minor characters who are subservient and generally not important to the plot. There are a few exceptions or a few cases of extremely racist caricatures of black people, including by Will Eisner, who is one of the most celebrated early cartoonists. And there they're depicted as, I mean, they're sidekicks. Usually not villains, usually childlike sidekicks who are just, you know, comic relief and buffoonish and completely defer to the white hero.
Hmm. Joel Benson, I know that one of the chapters you explored is not in the superhero realm, but these Western comics that, of course, are, you know, we don't really see those at all anymore. But once upon a time, they were really important. And I think your book tells us after World War II, superheroes, at least for a time, gave way to comic books that were set in the Old West with gunslingers and characters that could be thought of as white Indians, which kind of give us a whole different array of examples of some of this subtle racism and sometimes not so subtle racism that we see on the pages of comic books. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, one thing that Doug and I definitely wanted to do was to analyze comics other than superhero comics. We thought that was important and what might really single out our book as different from at least one other book that we know of that sort of deals in what we're dealing with that is primarily about superheroes. So we thought it was important to deal with other forms of comics, and so we deal with horror comics and jungle comics and westerns. And westerns was part of the early kind of comic book trade. I think that in the book that chapter is comes right after the early superheroes book. And a couple of things we found in looking at a lot of early Western comics were two primary figures. One was the gunslinger, and like you said, one was the white Indian. And one thing that I want to say, you know, comics have a way of also indoctrinating its readers. So comics perpetuate the ideologies that drive them. And so not only are they products of racism, but they also and oftentimes perpetuate that racism. And so when Doug's talking about the sort of horrific images of non-white people as villains, that has a way of indoctrinating its readers. And with regard to Westerns, of course, oftentimes the villains were Native Americans, and that the heroes were oftentimes one of two types of figures. Like I said, the gunslinger or the white Indian. The gunslinger, who we refer to as the bandit in the title, is a really interesting figure that we trace to figures, southern outlaws who emerged after Reconstruction or during Reconstruction. So Southern outlaws who did not want to adhere to the sort of Northern imposed new laws of emancipation and so became outlaws and robbed trains, and Jesse James would be one of these, who became this sort of iconic American hero who was born out of a kind of a racist backdrop. A lot of the characters we found in Westerns could be traced back to Jesse James. Another one that we looked at, another figure as far as Westerns, was the white Indian. And here was a character who some people call him the man who knows Indians. And Jonah Hex would be one of these figures. And this is a character who shared some cultural traits with Native Americans, but who was white and almost always sided with white people against Native Americans, even though they sort of shared certain characteristics or were somehow raised among Native American tribes. And actually, Jonah Hex was one who didn't always side with whites. So he was kind of a later version who kind of broke that mold.
Mm. So it's so fascinating to see things, you know, play out like that. And of course, we see that even in television and in other medias where some of those images stay with us. By the way, I'm wearing a Batman tie, and I remember... as I read your book, seeing with some shock that there are ways in which we can trace Batman and some of the elements of who he was to part of what you're talking about, and also to even tying him to the Ku Klux Klan, that there are certain similarities that we can tie between the kind of figure that Batman is and the typical hooded Ku Klux Klan member was. Is that just you looking back over the decades, drawing those connections, or are they more tangible connections than that?
I mean, I think the costume of the superheroes is it's one of the aspects of superheroes that was created by kind of amalgamating a bunch of different things that were really prevalent in popular culture during the day. So, you know, I mean, the Ku Klux Klan is not the only example of people wearing masks, right? There's a similarity though, and I mean in the 20s and 30s, I mean that was the period of sort of the second period of the KKK. They were an absolutely mass organization with a nationwide following. They had at least one national march in Washington D.C. that had like, I don't know, tens of thousands of people in it. So, you know, the imagery was out there.
And of course, they probably saw themselves in some ways as vigilantes of justice. Well, I mean, trying to right something that they thought was wrong.
That's absolutely how they saw themselves.
And the uniform was just one more way, you know, to sort of indicate that to the world, I suppose.
And I mean, just to complicate this a little bit more, I mean, one of the other inspirations for early superheroes was Zorro, who's another masked vigilante. And now, I mean, Zorro, interestingly, I mean, he was an upper class vigilante who sort of acted on behalf of the downtrodden masses. And that's kind of a theme that you see a lot in superhero comics where, you know, there needs to be this sort of strong masculine figure to come in and sort of right wrongs that ordinary people can't right for themselves. Zorro is not, I mean, as far as I know anyway, explicitly racist, but there were a lot of racially inflected images that got sort of funneled into superheroes, but you can't like pick them apart and say this one came directly from there. The whole trope of the vigilante seeker of justice, that you can trace pretty directly back to Southern veterans of the Civil War who refused to admit defeat. Now it goes in other directions after that, right? So I would say that, you know, this is one of those cases where, I mean, the racist origin of it kind of got, you know, whitewashed by history. And I don't think that like every vigilante is therefore necessarily an example of racism, but their white supremacy is built into the history of that in a way that just becomes invisible after a while.
Invisible yet unmistakable. I know that one of the things your book explores is, first of all, how in the early years, particularly in many comics, we don't see people of color at all. And often when we do, it's in sort of what we see now is kind of grotesque caricatures. Eventually, the comic industry seeks to reverse some of this or try to address some of these issues, particularly as the civil rights movement takes wing. And I don't know if you coined the term, but re-skinning, where in the comics not only do we start to see more people of color, but sometimes the heroes themselves become people of color. And sometimes a hero who once was white, suddenly we have a black Iron Man or a black Captain America. Joseph Benson, I know you wrote this chapter and tell the complicated story of what they were trying to do and how in at least some cases it pretty much failed.
Yeah, and I just for a second want to jump back to what Doug was saying, and anyone who is interested in the KKK as a kind of early image of superheroes should YouTube Birth of a Nation. There is a sequence in late in the film D.W. Griffith's famous film Birth of a Nation in the early 1900s when the KKK with full robe and on horses literally come in and save the day.
Yeah, ride to the rescue.
So
yeah.
That is just a very obvious precursor. But with respect to reskinning, what's interesting about that term is that, and Doug and I footnote this, is that when we were, you know, we presented a number of these chapters at conferences over the course of the time we were writing the book, and a few times at a great conference called PCA, ACA, Pop Culture Association, American Culture Association. And oftentimes you'll get really great, I mean, this is the reason why you do present at these conferences, is you get really great ideas in weird places. Sometimes a comment from a from somebody who's at the conference, and that's where we got reskinning. Somebody basically used that term. It was the Q&A after our presentation, and somebody used that term, and Doug and I kind of looked at each other and we're like, okay, you know, we're going to go ahead and just co-opt that. And so, you know, if that gentleman is listening and wants to call in or whatever, we can give that person credit. But this was something that the comic book industry clearly was interested in doing and was largely a failure, because what happens was, Green Lantern was one, Superman was another one. This kind of idea that they were going to basically take classic superheroes and essentially just turn them into the black counterparts without doing really anything else. Like, so they were basically just, you know, the black versions of these superheroes stuck into the white version of the comics, which of course doesn't do much to address, like we talked about earlier, the ideological forces. But I will say that there is one comic, and this is something that we talk about throughout the book. Not all comics were, you know, destructive in this way. That we sort of point to the potential for comics to actually be, very kind of progressive. And Captain America, actually, it's red, white, and
black. Truth.
Yeah, Truth. Red, white, and black tells the story of the black Captain America, Isaiah Bradley, And it's kind of a, you know, a revisionist sort of story, a, you know, a sort of a retcon story. And of course, comics have all kinds of origin stories, and there is no actual sort of the real origin of Batman or the real, you know, right? It's just, and Doug, it took me a while to realize this. I was like, well, that's not actually the origin. And Doug was like, no, you don't get it. It doesn't really matter. People can come in and create any kind of origin story. And so this was actually a very important comic, and one that we point to that kind of carries the potential for comics, and really just talks about Isaiah Bradley as somebody who took the super soldier serum, that was actually tested on black people, not unlike the Tuskegee Institute. Or the Tuskegee tests for what was the disease that they tested?
Syphilis.
Yes, syphilis, which was a sort of a horrific miscarriage of medicalization. And within this story, Isaiah Bradley all the black people who get the serum die, except for Isaiah Bradley, and he actually is instrumental in saving some Jewish people who are in concentration camps. But he is actually jailed in the comic for stealing Captain America's uniform, who eventually gets the serum once they get it right and they know it's not going to kill people. And so it really deconstructs the origin of Captain America and makes you realize that there was nothing actually special about Steve Rogers, Captain America, other than his whiteness. So this is a really powerful example of what comics can do.
And I would say, I mean, you know, the origin stories are super important for superheroes, as Joe said, and they get constantly retold, and in the process they get rewritten. I mean, there's like a mythic core to the origin. I mean, that remains basically stable, but the details always change. Like, you know, almost every time it gets told, the details shift a lot. So in a way, I mean, it's kind of like oral history, the way, you know, and I think, you know, Joe mentioned like the there was a first wave of reskinning in like the 80s and 90s, which I think, as Joe said, was basically unsuccessful because they just sort of they slotted usually black characters in to replace white characters when the white character had some kind of crisis. And it was temporary. And the black superhero was almost instantly getting undermined. Right. So like they were always being compared to the white character, and their shortcomings were constantly being pointed out until eventually they had a crisis and then the white character triumphantly returns. And none of this involved a rewriting of the origin story. What's different about Truth, which Joe explained really well, is that it rewrites the origin story. And it, you know, we were talking before about how black characters were missing from early superheroes. Truth goes back in and says, and again, it's totally, I mean, one of the brilliant things about Truth is it's totally in the tradition of rewriting origin stories. And it puts black people in the narrative where they hadn't been before. And so I think that's really a turning point where, it, you know, reskinning really, I think, did not turn out with good results in the 80s and 90s. Truth sets a new sort of, you know, path and shows this is how you can write this in a way that really has integrity and addresses the history of the medium with, you know, and it's a great story. It's totally self-aware about the whole history of the comics medium, not to mention U.S. history. And it just, so it works on every level. And, you know, I think it's still one of the best examples of this out there. But there are now a lot of others that have, you know, used this as kind of a template, to start actually moving the field and the medium forward, I would say.
Very good, and that's a good thing to see. At one point in the book, you say that comics and graphic novels are perhaps the least racially diverse medium in American popular culture, and I'm sure especially once upon a time that was true, maybe a little less true today, and you tell such an interesting story that delves into all kinds of other examples of the world of comics and graphic novels against this complicated and interesting backdrop. The book again is Bandits, Misfits, and Superheroes, Whiteness and Its Borderlands in American Comics and Graphic Novels, published by the University Press of Mississippi Jackson. Its co-authors Doug Singson and Joseph Benson. Gentlemen, you've written a really, really fascinating book, and I think as a comic book lover, I loved it, but I think even someone who's never held a comic book in their life, in their hands in their life, would find a lot that is important and fascinating here. So thank you for being here on the morning show to talk about your really interesting book.
Thanks, Craig. Thank you. Super fun.